Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Austin and Jim. Recently, Iran's been kicking up their heels again. When aren't they ever kicking up their heels, I guess we could say. But they made news over the Christmas time about shutting down the straits there. How realistic is that, Jim, that they would be able to do that?
Well, theoretically, they could do some damage. But you've got to look at this in the context of Iran's history, and there, and the history of the current religious dictatorship in Iran over, you know, since the 1980s. They tried something like this in the 1980s, and they got stomped on real big. Now, from what I hear from inside of Iran, this made a big impression on them. And their military planners have been trying ever since to come up with a way to basically get around that. Now, the Iranians are not stupid. They're pretty bright, even the ones working for the Islamic government. And they have come up with a lot of interesting ideas. The problem is, and they're aware of this, is that the other side, the United States, NATO, even the Arab states, which are paying a lot more attention to their defense situation these days, or for the last 10, 20 years, they are also coming up with ideas. And this is a classic peacetime situation where when the war breaks out, you find out whose ideas worked. You don't find that out until the shooting starts. That's just a fact of life, not just in the military sphere, but, you know, well, that's why we have a Super Bowl. that's why we have marketing campaigns that are often failures that, you know, reel back to just before the campaign kicked off. And everybody thinks it's a sure thing. I mean, one thing I learned in my 10-15 year career in marketing is no plan is perfect, and one thing you gotta watch out for is unexpected surprises. So this is very much more the case in military affairs because you don't have that many military campaigns. And what's shaping up in the Straits of Hormuz is surprises. Now both sides are aware of this. If you want to measure, you know, who's, you know, what the betting line is, getting back to the Super Bowl metaphor, the West, the Western side of this has the edge. The Iranians know they're the underdog. As far as they're concerned, anything less than a quick and decisive defeat would be a victory for them. So they're playing, you know, basically by a different set of, as we say, victory conditions. All the West wants to do is keep those straits open. As far as the Iranians are concerned, if they can close it down for 24, 46 hours, if they can get the insurance companies to pump the insurance rates up appreciably, which is a major factor because insurance in shipping oil is a major cost, they can declare victory. But in practical terms, and the Arabs are quick to point this out openly, one reason the Iranians won't do it is because the religious dictatorship in Iran is more dependent upon oil income than anybody else in the Persian Gulf area. Everybody else in the Persian Gulf area has other, you know, ways to get their oil out, is in a better financial situation, has a more stable political situation, et cetera, et cetera. Iran needs the oil more than anybody else does. So if they close the straits, who's going to be hurt the worst? Now, the Iranians won't say this, but their neighbors say, hey, these Iranians are playing mind games. And that gets back to what Austin was hinting at. You know, the Iranians always have a new super weapon, always have a new this, have a new that. And as we continually point out on the Strategy Page, we demolish each of these new announcements. It's all for propaganda. It's all for information war purposes. And it's mostly for domestic consumption. That's why a lot of this stuff, these new super weapons they're constantly announcing, you know, Americans, Westerners, Arabs who know anything about military affairs, you know, blink a little bit and say, what? What are they talking about? But if you're addressing a largely uneducated, barely literate audience, which is the base for the Islamic dictatorship in Iran, it looks quite different. So when Iran makes an announcement, you got to keep in mind who's it directed at.
Austin?
Jim's analysis is really good. Really good. I mean, he said all the major points. I think I'll take a long way around to develop a couple of them. I just 24 years ago, Joe Belkoski and I produced for Worldwide Wargaming a straight up Hormuz game called Light Division, and it really was looked at a closure of the Straits of Hormuz. It could have been done by the Khomeiniist regime in Tehran. You even had an enforced mix in there. Soviet Union. Remember the Soviet Union, USSR.
Yeah.
And it was looking at really a Carter Doctrine, which was enunciated in, 78, I guess, 1978, or maybe it was 77, by the Carter administration about the importance of the Persian Gulf. And we had gone through about a decade of moving from the RDF, remember the Rapid Deployment Force, which is now, CENTCOM. And so anyway, we put the game together, and the basic scenario is a U.S. response to not just clear the straits, but secure the straits. And it is a Marine and U.S. Army-led assault on Bandar al-Abbas, which is the major Iranian port. Now, the reason I bring that up is because I got the game out this week and said, okay, let's invent some new numbers for the Iranian force mix. And some of that I was using a couple of things that we've used had on strategy page about the status of Iranian forces that Jim's written. And then there were a couple of other articles I read over the weekend where people were talking about the state of the Iranian forces, what they could bring to bear, and how they might squeeze it. It is no military operation is a sure thing, but the United States, if that's what we wanted to do, was seize Bandar al-Abbas, and I'm talking about establishing a perimeter and to clear it out. We could do it. Now, but as Jim says, points out, take a look at the political elements in play. First of all, most likely it is Iranian bluster because, as Jim pointed out, they harm themselves economically. Oh, they pump themselves up with the polemics and rhetoric domestically by showing they're tough, but these guys know the economic downside. There's also the other component is that Jim was interesting that he was measuring it in hours, of 24 hours, 48 hours, closing it down. There's a possibility, and I'd be interested in Jim's response to this. There's some things they might be able to accomplish. Of course, now we're watching it very, very closely, but if we see a move by 800 speedboats out to drop mines off in that the tanker channel, boy, that's a huge intelligence indicator. But let's say they did seed several hundred mines in order to close the straits. They really haven't closed it, but what they have done is increase the shipping prices, spike the oil market, and let's say they've got their traders out there who know this is coming and reap some windfall profits. They're on playing the oil price spot market game. And how long does it take you to sweep those mines? Most of the mine sweeping that would go on is that we, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong on this, we rely on helicopters to do the identification, and those are vulnerable to anti-aircraft fire. We can suppress the missiles that would anti-aircraft missiles along the Iranian littoral, but to be sure you're going to have to end up with some, you know, not just attacks, but this leads into the possibility of actually making an incursion with soldiers, with Marine units. So it gets pretty complicated very rapidly, and you're not sure how long. It might not be 48 hours. It might be 21 days. Would the Iranians miscalculate like this? Well, again, I don't think they're stupid either. I think they're very canny. And again, I think the political explanation, the domestic political explanation, is the explanation. But Dan, dictatorships miscalculate. They have a terrible record throughout history of miscalculating. I don't see this really happening, especially before the American election. And I addressed this in a recent newspaper column I wrote. But you can't dismiss it. You can't dismiss the possibility of miscalculation by the Iranians. I mean, the ultimate show to show how strong they are is to handle a U.S. incursion at Bandar al-Abbas and say, hey, we're still standing. Is it in their interest to take international attention away from Syria? Now, that's one of the things I think that they've been playing, particularly starting in the fall, was to knock Syria out of the headlines. To some degree, they've been successful at that. They're more important, you know, because of the flow of oil coming out of the Persian Gulf. I wonder if that isn't a subsidiary political goal on their part when they threaten to close the Strait of Hormuz. Get back quickly to the point about how long they could have it shut down. I don't see it really being shut down to ship traffic for 30 days because there are too many that it's too many ships of naval vessels to be able to navigate it. But there would be risks to tankers. That you would have commercial shippers who don't want to go through it until they know that the mines are out of the way. And it's not just necessarily the you know, magnetic pressure mines or contact mines that they could sow out there. They're active type mines that are essentially seekers with firing torpedoes, and like there are all kinds of this. They're essentially naval booby traps for transiting closed waters like that. And there's an economic price. If perhaps the Iranian government calculates, we're willing to pay that economic price to show how intent we are on resisting pressure such as sanctions. And we're going to do it to you, and you all are going to pay a $30, $40, $50, $60 a barrel premium while those mines are out there. Does that redound on them? Is there backlash against them? Sure there is. But then as I, you know, what I'm laying out here is a way that a tyranny might miscalculate based on other pressures and, that, they think some of these results would be worth the problem of losing 30 days of their own oil sales. So, again, we don't know. There are surprises. Anybody who thinks they calculated this through has never been in a military operation. They don't know if they did it. They don't know for sure how it's going to end up, and we don't know either. But like I do say, looking at some of the models on this, we've got the combat power to do that. But do we incur other political risks and political backlash? Absolutely.
Now, we're not the only ones that are interested in keeping that open. I mean,
I think I said U.S. led, you know, Marines, Army on this. No, you all the Persian Gulf Arab states are very interested in keeping it open. And, well, Japan, China, do you want me to start naming the rest of the world, you know, with a possible exception of Russia, which, meaning its own immediate domestic needs. It's the rest of the world is very interested in maintaining. All told, I think it's about 20% of the exported oil, and it's 30 to 35% of the oil that moves by tanker traffic passes through that strait every day. So
yeah, Russia is the one country that benefits the most from the Straits of Hormuz being shut down because they're a oil exporter. In fact, that's a major source of foreign exchange for them. And if the price went up and stayed up for a while, the Russians would make a lot of money without making any enemies. Something else to keep in mind is there would be a diplomatic war going on, probably off to the side where, privately, because there'd be an escalation ladder. There are many things that Iran can lose. They can lose their pumping facilities. They can lose, their oil fields can be shot up really bad. How long do you want to have, how much damage do you want? Depending on how you hit them, and how often you hit them, you can shut their fields down for over a year. You can attack all their military facilities. You can attack other industrial facilities. That kind of hostility by Iran, basically gives you a blank check to go after their nuclear research facilities on a sustained basis. Now, the minute they do something, Western diplomats say, okay, through party representatives, whatever. As Austin points out, everybody's involved in this one way or another, mostly on the downside. So it's got everybody's attention. And they basically read the Iranians the list. And they say, all right, how far do you want to go? If you do something in the Gulf and we don't hear from you in 24 hours, we're going to go up to the first rung of the ladder. And every day thereafter, bing, 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 bing. So you can stop it anytime you want. Just let us know. Meanwhile, we have all those bombers standing by. And the Iranians, I'm sure, are aware of this. That's why, the Arabs tend to say the Iranians are blowing smoke. There's no way they're going to risk that much by messing around with Straits of Hormuz.
Until they get a nuclear weapon, that changes some of the...
It changes it a little bit, but even the Arabs aren't too worried about that. The Arabs feel, again, what I'm told from the Arab street, the people we have in the Arabia, as it were, Saudi Arabia and what have you, Qatar, who are basically there, they're saying, the Arabs feel that they could easily deal with any impact of the Iranian bomb by having an Arabian bomb. And the Saudis have looked into this for a long time. Indeed, for a while, there was a huge stink in Washington and several other world capitals over the Saudis trying to make a deal with Pakistan to buy a few nuclear weapons. Now, that deal may still be there, simply on hiatus. But that would solve a lot of problems for both countries. And basically nobody in the West is going to get too bent out of shape. The Israelis might, but basically even the Israelis realize that bomb is for protection against Iran, not Israel. So it's the nuclear, mutually assured destruction involves nuclear weapons, but from Iran's point of view, it isn't carried out by nuclear weapons. It makes their threats a little more credible, but not credible enough. If they shut down or try to shut down the Straits of Hormuz, all bets are off, nuclear weapons or not.
Right. Now, the other weapons that we've talked about, the mines and the different types of mines they could deploy, but do they not also have the silkworm missiles?
Yes. The mines are the most, as Austin points out, the mines are the worst, because they're the most difficult to deal with. Now, there's a lot of mine clearing equipment in the Persian Gulf on the Arab side, the western side of the Gulf, because it's understood that mines are the one weapon that the Iranians could easily employ and would have the greatest impact. Their missiles have to be launched largely from above ground. I mean, the Iranians also talk about their submarines and what have you, but as a practical matter, they have a lot of those silkworm missiles, which are the Chinese equivalent of the American harpoon. and they can be effective. There are countermeasures for them. The most effective countermeasure is destroying them before they're firing. And that's why I say the ladder of escalation involves a lot of smart bombs and intelligence work that's been done for a long time. I think somebody went public with the fact that there's a joint special operations task force, and has been for several years, in the Persian Gulf, directed at Iran. Well, that should be no surprise to anybody who follows this sort of thing. They have been doing this targeting analysis for a long time, and that's a business that has to be updated hourly, daily, constantly. So if it comes to a shooting, you know, situation, we're basically going to be going after all their munitions, especially their missiles and their mines. You want to get them before they get into the water or get fired. And you won't get them all, but if you get a lot of them, basically you eliminate a lot of the danger. That's part of the game, you know, this peacetime planning, you know, exercise on both sides. Whoever does it best comes out looking best when the shooting starts.
Right. And basically their Navy consists of small patrol boats, maybe some frigates, right?
Some old frigates. They're homemade frigates, which are fairly crude. They're putting into the Caspian Sea, which is a wise move. They're more likely to, you know, survive any war. Not guaranteed, but more likely. The Navy is basically a Coast Guard. They have some submarines, some miniature submarines. They have a lot of different types of high-speed, small craft, you know, speedboats and what have you. And they are mostly for show. They're mostly for domestic consumption. Naval people, I have consulted, you know, basically, you know, looking at it in a tactical situation, see these things as more target practice than anything else. But again, they got to remember, the Iranians are building this stuff for a different audience. It's not for our benefit.
Right. Yeah. It's lies and more lies.
Exactly. And they wanted to play in the Iranian equivalent of Peoria. Because
right.
It's in the back country of Iran, where the religious dictatorship, which has the support of maybe 20-30% of the population, but it's the rural population, the more religiously conservative population, that's where they get their guys for the Basij, you know, the various secret police and paramilitary forces that are fanatically loyal to the religious leaders. That's what keeps them in power. They got to keep those people happy, and it takes more than a paycheck. So they give them the kind of, you know, ticker toy, you know, cartoonish, you know, type weapons that impress their target audience, so to speak.
Now, if they started putting mines into the strait, how soon would we be able to detect that?
Immediately.
Yeah, I gave you a scenario of that using small boats. There are other ways to do it. You know, theoretically, you could have... You know, they do have some submarines, which we watch very, very closely, and they could be using those to drop the mines. They could try it surreptitiously with fishing boats to do it. You know, the scenario I gave was a little bit cheeky earlier in the podcast, where I said, you know, 800 speedboats, and we moved to the
right.
Middle and dropped.
Yeah, fishing boat or one of those coastal, you know, cargo ships, those dhows or something like that.
Think back to the, Jim, what was it, 87, 88, the tank
yeah,
war?
Yeah, yeah, the tank war.
And that went on. There were reports, and I think they were credible, of the Iranians and perhaps some at the time Libyan connivance of merchant ships or small coastal steamers that had dropped off some of the...
There was that time also in the 80s where Libya used a merchant ship to drop some mines in the Red Sea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were caught. That's why I say, you know, the Straits of Hormuz are most likely monitored 24/7. And as Austin just pointed out, you know, any of their submarines or any other of their ships, you know, are also watched very carefully. The intelligence people have basically a checklist. things that basically, if you get enough point, you know, everything has a point value to it. That's the way it's long been done. And if you see this, if you see this, if you see that, you hit the button. Everybody goes up a level in alertness. You know, when, you know, forces start getting moved. You know, the Europeans are told, hey, we're going to fly in some more of your, we're going to pick up some more of your mine clearing, gear and fly it off to the Persian Gulf, stuff like that. The first phase of this that you might see, the Iranians are aware of this, they might start playing this. I mean, they learn, you know, they've learned over the years how to play with the enemy intelligence people. And, they would go through some of these, you know, coming up to the line and then pulling back. But they're playing with fire because the other side, remember, the fundamental fact here is we can hurt them more than they can hurt us.
Right.
And they are aware of that.
Right. Now, speaking of their other plane with us, we just probably a couple of days ago, we put up the article on the drone and what we think finally happened with that and how they had reconstructed the drone probably after it crashed.
Yeah. Well, the Air Force announced that they know what brought the RQ-170 down, but they won't say. Which indicates that it's a trick that they're not sure the Iranians are even aware of. I mean, what that leads you to believe is that the Iranians got a report from some local cop out in the eastern hinterlands saying, hey, this plane came down, there's no pilot, it's a funny looking plane, oh, here's my cell phone picture, and then bells went off, and they, hey, we got gold here. So, I mean, that's what it would indicate, the Air Force not wanting to say how it came down. The Iranians, like I say, are smart. They're quick. Say, hey, how are we going to spin this? Well, first, let's put this sucker back together. Give it a new paint job. And that's what, you know, was obvious to a lot of observers, and especially people in the military, but also a lot of knowledgeable civilians said, hey, wait a minute, there's something odd about that. You can't see the landing gear, and that's not a, you know, a mil-spec, you know, military specification paint job. I suspect that there were technical problems, as there have been with many of different types of drones. They don't all use a standard system for communication. The 170, you know, simply crashed, as a lot of them do. And as we pointed out in the article, we won't know all that was at risk here in terms of technical information. You know, there's all sorts of stories about what kind of sensors were on the 170. I mean, let's face it, and we've reported this years ago, the big thing with the 170, it's got some stealthiness. In other words, it can go into hostile airspace. But basically, it's just another, you know, it's faster because it's jet-propelled. You know, it's more of a military, you know, wartime-type reconnaissance aircraft where it can dash into territory that could possibly be defended by air defenses or interceptors and take some pictures and then get out in one piece. And here we have a case where, you know, it appears that the Iranians aren't even detecting this, or if they're detecting it, it's not in any, they're not detecting it in any way to be able to do anything about it. And the damn thing, you know, just had an electrical, mechanical, whatever failure and came down, or communications failure. But beyond that, there's no big deal. You know, it's Occam's razor. You know, the simplest explanation is probably the most likely one. Because otherwise, all I see people doing is blowing smoke. The Iranians tried to do a dog and pony show, which they weren't careful enough. I mean, the mistakes they made, you know, they shouldn't have made. You know, the paint job is fairly obvious. So as clever as they are, they didn't think to bring in an expert on, you know, American aircraft. Because, you know, just somebody who basically spends a lot of time on the net, and I know the Iranians have a lot of people who spend a lot of time on the net, you know, would have been able to pull up a picture and say, oh, here's what it should look like. So bring in an art director, you know, some guy who knows from colors and paints, and let's match this as closely as possible. And then not leave it, as a new paint job. And this is an aircraft that's been over there for months, you know, so you gotta have it roughed up a little bit. They made a mistake. And you can bet they won't make that mistake the next time because now they're, oh, how stupid.
Yeah. Well, I even saw where the wings were connected to the fuselage on a close-up that it looked like there was tape holding something
together. Exactly. Yeah. So now they know, well, yeah, I mean, they're harassing the crap out of the Iranian movie-making community, which is another little sideshow which doesn't get much publicity, but they're really leaning on these people. They might take a few of them and say, hey, look, you know, we'll do you some favors if you stand by and come in here and do this and that, you know, if you need us. I mean, they make deals like that all the time with people. Hey, well, you can make that movie which we didn't like that we can live with, et cetera, et cetera. And they could do it. They had the talent. But, you know, somebody got a little ahead of themselves. They thought they were more clever than they actually were, but they came close. They could have pulled it off, which is something to remember.
Right. Well, I'm sure that they're going to be a pain in everybody's side for years to come, and we pray to God that they don't get nukes.
Well, something never changes, and that's one of them. Yeah. Iran being annoying.
Yes. Well, that finishes up our time today, gentlemen, and we'll talk to you next time. We'll see you.
Bye, then.
Bye.